Welcome to the SAFM Market Update with MoneyWeb, leading the business conversation right here on SAFM.
Thank you very much to Greg for that news update. There'll be more news with Greg at 7 o'clock. It was economist Paul Samuelson who once said that investing should be more like watching paint dry or watching grass grow. If you want excitement, take $800 and go to Las Vegas. I'm Jimmy Miaha. This is the SAFM Market Update. Let's get you up to date. Coming up on the show today, we take a look at the latest proposals being put forward by the Department of Electricity around pricing policies and how it is that we should be paying for our electricity. We speak to the Minister of Electricity, Dr. Hossein Soramokgopa, get his thoughts around today's briefing that he held with the media to outline the draft policy that is set to be gazetted later in this week. We also have a conversation with Business Unity South Africa's board member, Dr. Stavros Nicolaou, on the SADC summit that concluded yesterday in the KZN province. The summit focused on infrastructure development as a potential key for rebuilding regional relationships. We're going to take a look at that in a bit more detail and see what we make of some of those other outcomes. Then we have a conversation with the Fuels Industry Association of South Africa on the potential slate levy adjustments and how it is that they could benefit our local markets in times of increased volatility. We take a look at that and see if we can benefit from some of the proposals that are being put forward here. Then we have a conversation with Nedbank Agriculture on the support that they offer to the agricultural landscape and to farmers around precision farming and that particular type of farming infrastructure. We wrap up the show as we do every other Tuesday, rather, with a property conversation. We're going to be taking a look at the vote by Baldwin shareholders to move ahead with the PIC's deal that was initially penned a couple of weeks ago. We try and make sense of that with independent property economist John Lewis and get his thoughts around whether or not that deal is going to be in the best interests of the shareholders and potentially even the Public Investment Corporation.
The day's markets. Clear insights on today's winners, losers, and what to do next.
As always, that's where we kick off the show with a sense of market movements that have been unfolding throughout the day. We're going to be taking a look at these with Managing Director at Wealth Strat, Victoria Rivers. She joins me on the line now to see what's been moving the markets today. Victoria, lovely having you on the show. As always, thanks so much for taking the time. The President of the United States can't seem to sit still, now threatening Oman with war if it stands in the way of the United States. The oil price back above $90 a barrel. Markets having a bit of an offish day. We were doing so, so well.
Jimmy, good evening. You're right, but we are in a bit of a yo-yo market at the moment. Every time Trump does reignite war, and the oil price is the escape valve. And as you say, we saw it above $91 a barrel, which is its highest level in over 2 weeks. And that's obviously spooked markets. We've seen a classic risk off in the U.S. this morning. This morning in the U.S. for us in this afternoon. And stocks are pretty much lower across the board.
Victoria, Asian markets, Asian stocks, the Nikkei, biggest loser on the day across all of the international markets. Of course, US markets are still trading at the moment, but the Nikkei shedding more than 2% from their perspective. I know there's been a lot of talk around the Japanese economy and what's been happening there. The US has come out to confirm that they would like to be getting involved in the stabilization of the Japanese yen. That happened a couple of weeks ago as well. But markets very, very jittery, and seemingly the Nikkei bearing the brunt of it, even though I think the comments by President Trump came after the Nikkei would have traded for their morning trading session effectively.
Yeah, what you're seeing, and it was led by the Japanese market, is that the equities are reacting to bond yields. And you saw Japanese bond yields rise quite sharply. The 30-year bonds hit multi-decade highs. And that really put pressure on the equity market. The same can be said for the US. So, you know, higher oils putting a lot of inflation pressure into the system, and ultimately bond yields are taking the brunt of that. Again, with US bond yields at highest levels we've seen since 2007, which has really caused a lot of the tech-heavy stocks to sell off. And the same can be said for the Nikkei.
Victoria, locally, resource stocks came under a bit of pressure. Yesterday, they were the darlings of the day, up about 3% off of some positive sentiment and some positive moves. Today, the biggest loser on the day. But given that no sector was really spared locally, it's clear that South Africa as a market is still very subjected to what's happening in the global landscape.
I mean, that is true. But just having said that, our market was effectively flat for the day, so only down by like about 0.5. And I think the thing that's very interesting for us is the rand that's actually been so stable through this period. So you're right, we're a tiny little economy. We're always going to be the tail of the dog. We're going to be affected by global markets. What happens? It's unlikely for us to have a positive day on the back of global negativity. And our resources, being the largest component of our market, are very sensitive to that. But as I say, I would like to just draw your attention to the rand that's actually held really firm today at about 16.15 to the dollar. So we find this quite interesting because obviously the rising oil price is a bit of a threat to that strength. But right now, you know, the metal prices and the kind of the softish dollar are also affecting or providing a bit of a cushion for the rand.
Victoria, let's look into the rand, not just today. I mean, you mentioned that it's held its ground today, but I noted that it's really held its ground for longer than today, for the majority of the year, since breaking below those key 17, 18, 19 rand levels that were shocking to all of us. We have been able to maintain some really good strength on the rand, especially against the US dollar, at a time where the rand as an emerging market currency is so heavily traded. There's a lot of liquidity in there. It is a proxy for a lot of risk sentiment in emerging markets. But I want to say that to add on to your statement, the rand has really held its value over the course of the year.
There are a number of factors that really support that. So the first is obviously the weaker dollar. So we're just the reflection of that, or the other side of that trade. But I guess to the euro and the pound, we've also been relatively constant and strong. The second is the emerging market appetite that foreign investors have. And I think the third point is really just to look at the fundamentals in South Africa that have been improving. I mean, I know it's for different reasons, but we have a very similar inflation level to the US right now. And in previous years, you know, we had double, almost triple US inflation. So it's a combination of a number of factors, but a strong rand is ultimately very good for us because we import most of our inflation through the oil price and through our, you know, obviously importing it. So a strong rand really does bode well for us longer term.
Victoria, before I let you go, I want to take a look at the gold price, something else, or gold and platinum. I suppose we might as well take a look at the precious metals side of things. They do also provide a good barometer of the strength of our mining sector. We're a good platinum producer, we're a good gold producing nation, and there's a bit of volatility on today's pricing, but overall still above 1,700 in case of platinum, still above 4,300 in case of the gold price in US dollars. Those elevated prices should more than likely bode well for our mining sector stocks locally.
Absolutely. Over a third of our market is made up of mining shares. I mean, gold is really the anti-US trade. It's that at the moment you can build a case for anything for gold. It's been behaving like an equity as well. And then there's the fundamental use case for platinum. So both of those prices have picked up quite meaningfully. And as I say, super positive for our market and for investors.
Lots to be positive and optimistic about, even amidst all of the uncertainty that keeps being re-injected into the markets, largely by the United States. We'll see how markets continue to move. For now, we'll leave the conversation on that note. Managing Director at Wealthstrat, Victoria Ruvers, joining us to take a look at markets and share her thoughts around some of the positive sentiment that we're able to enjoy at the moment.
We're not just interested in banking businesses. We're interested in building better ones. Because the true value of a bank isn't what it provides. It's what it makes possible. Simpler operations, greater adaptability, long-term resilience. Think bigger. Think Nedbank Commercial Banking. See money differently. Nedbank. We're licensed FSP and registered credit provider. T's and C's apply.
Did you know that South Africa has one of the highest crypto adoption rates in the world? Fact. With that comes massive innovation and new opportunities. Stablecoins are the new buzzword in the industry. These are crypto versions of the rand, the euro, and the US dollar. But what's coming is even more exciting. Being able to borrow against your crypto and buying tokenized real-world assets such as stocks, wine, football teams, and real estate. Join me, Kieran Ryan, on the MoneyWeb Crypto Podcast each week to stay on top of what's happening in the fascinating world of crypto.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
Earlier today, the Minister of Electricity, Dr. Hosensu Ramokopa, held a media briefing to outline South Africa's revised electricity pricing policy. This policy is currently in a draft stage and will be gazetted later in this week. We're going to be taking a look at this in a bit more detail with the Minister himself. He joins me on the line now to see what we make of this policy and where it puts our electricity conversation. Malumis Butla, lovely having you on the show as always. Thank you so much for taking the time. Let's perhaps start our conversation with an overview around the necessity for introducing this policy. South Africa has had quite a bit of change happen in the pricing structure of electricity over the years, especially if I think from 2007 right through to today. The last 20 years have been quite the change in landscape. Take us through the need for introducing this policy at this time.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you very much, Jimmy, and good evening to you and the listeners. You're absolutely correct. I think a lot has changed over that 17-year period. The last time we had a policy of this nature was in 2008. So first is the significant change in the consumption patterns of households. I mean, if you look at, let me just take the poorest of the poor and someone who live in a shack dwelling in an informal settlement today. People in that household, almost all of them will have access to a cell phone. They'll have a television set. They'll have a fridge. They'll have an electric kettle. And the same cannot be said about that situation about 2008. So the consumption profile has changed and changed significantly. When you go to the affluent, what are we seeing now? There's less and less reliance on Eskom as a result, in part of load shedding, the incentives that were introduced as part of the Energy Action Plan to incentivize rooftop solar installation. We also know that what has changed over that period is that we are now introducing the South Africa wholesale electricity market. There's now multiple generators, and we're going to get to a stage where we're also going to have the wholesalers who are going to be part of this ecosystem. So they need to be informed by some overarching pricing policy that can determine what the rules will look like from a pricing point of view. We're seeing increasingly the proliferation of estate and closed estate. They are buying in bulk from either the municipality or Eskom, and then they on-sell it or reticulate it in those estates. And that in the process of that, they levy surcharges. And most significantly, over the period under review 2008 to now, electricity has increased by about 907%. That is a tariff increase. Over the same period, the inflation has increased about 150%. It's an untenable situation. It's eroding the disposable income of households. And as you know, that the household consumption is a big part of South Africa's economy, approximately 60% of that. And we're also seeing that our industries are becoming less and less competitive, so we are unable to build a very strong, well-oiled export industry because of the uncompetitive nature in part of electricity pricing, especially for the energy-intensive users. But also the small and medium businesses in the townships, they are finding it increasingly difficult, undermining their entrepreneurial spirit and prowess. The ability of the South African economy to grow is undermined by electricity prices. So it is our view that it is about time for us to ensure that we revise the policy, and we put forward a number of proposals that we want the general public to comment on, and hopefully in the next 30 days we'll have received comprehensive comments, and on the back of that, I go back to cabinet and then firm up the policy, and then it will find expression in the regulation, the manner in which NERSA going forward, they will conduct its oversight role, and so that the rules are complied with, and also municipalities and ESCOM will now be subject to this pricing policy, Jimmy.
Minister, can we take a look at the policy proposals in a couple of parts?
Yes.
Let's perhaps start with what is being proposed for households. I know you and I in the past have spoken about indigenous households and getting more free electricity to those households at a retail level. And they've also been the households have been the group that's benefited the least, or that's been subjected to those 900% increases that you touched on. An average of more than 45% per year is not sustainable by any stretch. Let's perhaps start with the proposals for them and then look at the proposals for businesses and that after that.
Okay. Yeah, so let me do it by first the benefit to everyone, and then I'll come specifically to indigent and then business. So what we're saying here is to advocate for what we call an efficiency-based pricing. What do we mean, Jimmy and the listeners, is that the bills must be unbundled to indicate the following amongst others. First is the energy cost. I mean, now when you receive a bill, it's an aggregate bill, so you just say electricity, you owe us 600 rand, as an example. So we say, no, you must disaggregate it further. So you must show the energy costs. What are the network charges? So the energy cost, really, to the listeners, it talks to what is the cost of converting, in this instance, coal to electricity. So that's what's happening at the generation level. And then the cost of what we call network charges, the transmission and reticulation. So getting that electricity into your house, it goes through, if you like, highways in the form of big transmission lines, and then it takes the off-ramp, then it gets to municipalities, gets to the pole close to your house, and then ultimately gets to your house. We need to account for that cost, and it must be reflected in the bill. And then any ancillary charges, so this will have to do with municipalities. Perhaps they've installed a transformer to bring down the intensity of the electricity, so that cost must be reflected. And also the cost of municipal charges. By that we mean the municipality will group in the workforce that is responsible for the delivery of electricity. It will be administration, is the chaps who are doing maintenance and the like. If you like, salary bill gets to be aggregated. So it's a cost of constitute the cost of delivering electricity to the end consumer. So we also need to know how you account for that in the bill. More significantly, Jimmy, is the following: is that you and I and all consumers are burdened by the inefficiencies of ESCOM and municipalities. What do I mean by that? So we know that there's what we call technical losses, because municipality and ESCOM have not invested in the reticulation side of the infrastructure. There are line losses. So the ESCOM municipalities will buy 10 rands worth of electricity. Before they can even supply to end consumers, they have lost 3 rands worth of that electricity. So there's no room to recover, because they have lost it as a result of the network that is decaying and that is aging. So what municipalities and ESCOM typically do is that 3 rands that they've lost as a result of their lack of planning, a poor capital allocation in refurbishing and maintaining the infrastructure, they factor it in the tariff. So you are a casualty of inefficiencies from a planning side. The second thing that they will do is on what we call non-technical losses, their illegal connections. When we drive some of the informal settlements, including big industries, including the big suburbs, the people who have just connected themselves illegal. So instead of municipalities and ESCOM removing that the illegal connections, those losses, then they get to factor them in the tariff. And then there are those who choose not to pay, and they've got the ability to pay. And those contribute to the rising debt level, that which municipalities owe to ESCOM. Now that figure is 110 billion. And that which customers owe to municipalities that direct, that they provide the electricity directly to them, that figure is sitting at about 450 billion. So if you put it together, the debt is about 560 billion. So what do municipalities and ESCOM do? their inability or their lack of enthusiasm to collect that money is then factored into the tariff. Let me give you a live example. The current tariff that we are paying now, there's about 1.5 percentage point of that tariff. That is in lieu of Eskom's inability to collect the debt. So we say, no, that can't be the case. So what you are doing essentially is that you are burdening the diligent consumer. So you are as a result of Ramkopa not paying electricity and resulting in increasing debt, what we do, we choose to penalize Jimmy. Jimmy is a diligent payer, so Jimmy must pay us more because we are going to factor that into the tariff. We say, no, that's unacceptable, so you determine the rules. So NERSA, as the regulator, will say, there's a threshold above which you cannot factor that amount into the tariff. So how do you arrive at that threshold? There's an internationally recognized best practice of what should constitute technical losses. Anything above that, municipalities can recover it from the tariff. So that applies to everyone. Now, having said all of the above, you have unbundled the tariff, you account for everything, you remove all the hidden costs. Because what you are seeing now, you find that people in the suburb, more affluent suburbs, I levied significantly higher tariffs on account of cross-subsidization, when in fact the costs are hidden. So we say, no, make all the costs visible to everyone. In instances where there's cross-subsidization, we know how it obtains. It's in the time of use and also the quantum of consumption. And typically, an affluent household will have a pool pump. They'll have multiple rooms, multiple geysers, and therefore their consumption is higher. And once you reach a particular threshold, also the rate of the tariff is higher. That's how you achieve a cross-subsidization. But currently the situation is that it is hidden, so you really don't have an appreciation of what that is. The less affluent, less privileged, so you determine a threshold of what is the qualification to be considered a poor household. Generally, what municipalities have been doing, they say total household income 3,500 and less, you qualify to be indigent. That's fine. But in terms of that indigent policy, we said those who are qualifying households are entitled to 50 kilowatt hour of electricity per month for free. I just said when I started that the consumption profile have changed. And in fact, Eskom and municipalities have got real-time data. It's longitudinal data over that period of time. We are able to see what has been the change in profile. We know now that to achieve the level of subsidization and relief to the poor, we need to peg that at the range of anything between 200 to 300 kilowatt hour per month of free electricity. But the point we're making is that we don't need new money. So already National Treasury, Jimmy and the listeners, provides about 21 billion rand for free basic electricity. You add sanitation, I think that total amount of subsidy support from National Treasury is about 75 billion. But electricity share of that is 21 billion. So our view is that within that resource envelope, we don't want additional allocation from National Treasury. We are able to achieve that free basic electricity of anything between 200 and 300. How do we achieve that? First, we undermine leakage. There's a lot of households that qualify for free basic electricity, but they don't get that allocation per month because of the leakage. How does the leakage occur? The money flows through the municipalities. It's not the conditional grant. It's clubbed with all the grants given to municipalities. What municipalities do when it reaches them, they reallocate it to other spending pressures. The same applies to Eskom, because Eskom relies on municipalities to put together an indigent register. There's very few credible indigent registers in the country. So the money is lost in the system. People don't benefit. To give you and the listeners a sense, that 21 billion can support about 2.5 million people, household, I'm sorry, consumers in the country. Only 400,000 of the 2.4 million are getting that subsidy. 2 million households are not getting it as a result of the leakage. So that's one. Two is that instead of continued over-reliance on fiscal support, What we can do is to build microgrids in the form of solar PV hybrid solutions. And then we know now we're bringing down the cost of primary energy because we're using sun and then we store it. And then during this peak period, we draw from the storage, that's the battery. We have live examples. We have rolled out multiple grids. The latest microgrids, I'm sorry, the latest that we have done is in the two villages of Mavet and Madimbo in Musina. That program has been running for close to a year, 1 gigawatt of supply. We know that we can really suppress the cost of electricity, significantly lower than what even Eskom generates. So we know it's possible. So you're going to use part of the 21 billion to build this grid. And we don't have to be reliant on the fiscus into perpetuity. And that's the point we are making. The last one is on the negotiated price agreements. What are these NPAs in short? These were instruments in the erstwhile or the current electricity pricing policy, which we are updating, that says that the industries that are in distress can go to Eskom and then go to the regulator and ask for a relief from a tariff point of view. And really, these are industries that are energy intensive users. The recent example is what we have done with Lenco and Somanco. They issued Section 189 notices on the back of their inability to compete with the Chinese players because the Chinese smelters are significantly subsidized. The 62 cents kilowatt hour of electricity, they were paying us Eskom about 135. They can't compete. And then there's a number of requirements. There's a minimum amount of electricity you must consume. You must run the machines for 24 hours. There's a qualification criteria. They met all of that. We gave them the 62 cents. We are now doing about 7 other entities. They're in a different category. They are subjected to that robust treatment. Remember, the key here, Jimmy, is that we are not going to socialize that cost. So Eskom has got a clinical way of how we were able to accommodate, absorb that reduction in the tariff. So that instrument was used solely to provide relief to companies that are in distress. This policy makes another argument, is that that's the one side. The other side is that you can use electricity as a lever to catalyze the South African economy. So DTIC can identify as part of the industrialization strategy to say, no, but there are these sectors that gives us, if they were to be supported, they are likely going to give us the fastest growth, employment absorption, they are transformative, whatever the case may be. And if they were to be given a reduced tariff, they are likely going to thrive. So in this instance, it's not a defensive instrument. It's an offensive one. Offensive in that you see an opportunity, you are pursuing it. So we are making provision for that in this policy. And the last 2 points I want to make is that we also are incentivizing rooftop solar. But this is what we are doing on the rooftop solar. It's really about net billing. So what we're doing is that there are periods of the day where you have installed rooftop solar, you generate maximum electricity that your system can generate, possibly theoretically generate. You feed it back into the grid, and then during this period you are drawing from the grid. So we're saying that we are going to net it, and then where there's a positive, we credit to your bill. So it's not a physical transfer of money, it's not an exchange of money, but it's how we credit your bill. So in this way, people can see the return on investments on their rollout of rooftop, because you can see the bill is coming down substantively. Oh, let me just make the last point is that there's an issue of resellers in the country. So you have a Jimmy who stays in a suburb somewhere in Mooi Kloof, Pretoria East. The person who developed the estate buys electricity from Tshwane for bulk, or buys a bulk from Eskom and then resells it to the developers in that estate. And he places a surcharge on that. We say, no, it can't be arbitrary, that surcharge. You must show that there's value you have added. So if you have reticulated, there's a You have connected the houses. There's a transformer that you have bought using your own money. Account for that, but it can't be arbitrary. You go to a township, my mother's house there, you find that there are backyard dwellers. Someone purchases electricity, of course, gives to the tenants, but charges the tenants significantly more than what he or she purchases from the municipality. He says, no, that can't be allowed. So we'll come with the regulations on behalf of the, on the back of policy to define the role of the resellers, because people are overburdened in some of these estates. Of course, I mean, they come, many of them as a result of seeking for security, at least those who are affluent. But then you get to be subjected to these costs, which are arbitrary. So that's what the pricing policy does, Jimmy, in a nutshell. And we are inviting comments from the public.
A revision of South Africa's electricity pricing policy is underway, and its fundamental goal is to ensure better equitable distribution of electricity and more affordable electricity for South African households. We'll have to leave the conversation on that note. Dr. Josensu Ramokgopa, Minister of Electricity, giving us a sense of the policy currently out for comment and what would be gazetted to Parliament after that comment window has closed.
Look, being able to say my partner and I have traveled to 52 countries in 5 years is a great conversation starter. But that's not why I'm at Atlanta Standard Bank Private. It's for moments like these. Babe, will you marry me?
Yes!
It's not what you do that matters, but who you do it for. Get up to 50% back in UCount rewards points on domestic and international flights. Search UCount Travel Mall to find out more. Standard Bank. It can be. Standard Bank is an authorized FSP and registered credit provider. T's and C's apply.
Did you know? A soil sample gives you a comprehensive understanding of your soil. Through soil, sap, and leaf analysis, Omnia helps turn data into practical, producer-relevant recommendations. Because when you understand your soil properly, you can make better decisions in the field. Omnia Nutriology. Better farming starts with understanding your soil.
We're not just interested in banking businesses. We're interested in building better ones. Because the true value of a bank isn't what it provides. It's what it makes possible. Simpler operations, greater adaptability, long-term resilience. Think bigger. Think NetBank Commercial Banking. See money differently. NetBank. We're licensed FSP and registered credit provider. T's and C's apply.
SFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha.
This feature is brought to you by NetBank Commercial Banking. Grow your agribusiness. Think bigger. Think NetBank Commercial Banking. See money differently. NetBank.
The edge in agriculture comes from being precise and deliberate in how it is that you farm and render your agricultural services. And that's exactly what we're going to be taking a look at with the team at Nedbank Agriculture. We're going to be diving into the world of precision agriculture and trying to make sense of how that can give our farmers an edge in South Africa. I'm joined on the line by Head of Sales at Nedbank Agriculture, Daniel Rousseau, to take a look at this and see what we make of it. Daniel, lovely having you on the show as always. Thanks so much for taking the time. What is precision agriculture in the context of agriculture? Culture and farming, and why is it becoming so important in South Africa?
Yeah, I think let's start with the why, if it's okay. And you remember we had the discussion around regenerative agriculture a few weeks ago. So just to follow on, you know, if you look at our farmers, they operate in a very, very challenging business environment, impacted by global trade, climate change, very important, as well as geopolitics. So most of our farmers and primary producers are actually price takers with very low margin, and they rely on increased yields and lower input costs, you know, to remain profitable over the long term, to remain sustainable. So then if you look at precision agriculture, what it is, we can talk around precision farming or even smart farming, but it is a modern agricultural management strategy that collects, process, and analyze data. So it's very much data-driven from crops, soil, and even environmental conditions, you know, to make informed decisions for farming operations. So the main goal is to maximize crop yields, to look at improving efficiencies, also reducing waste, and promote environmental sustainability. by tailoring farming practices to the specific need of different areas, you know, within a field. So it is very specific farming practices.
Daniel, I suppose that's where technology lends itself to being quite a useful aid in the agricultural process. You and I have spoken in the past around regenerative agriculture and the use of technologies there, but I'm guessing from a precision agriculture perspective, if you're looking to be absolutely precise and very deliberate in your farming approach, technology plays a critical part here.
Yes, no, definitely. And, you know, we've seen that adoption of technology over the last 10 years specifically, growing exponentially. Very much in the GPS space, so the global positioning systems, and even geographic information systems, we call it GIS. So they make use of satellites as well as drone technology, as an example now, to enable very accurate mapping of fields. It's very interesting, actually. And then tracking machinery and monitoring spatial variability in soil and crops. But that's only one part. You know, they look a lot on sensors as well. And I've mentioned the drones and satellite imaging. But everything then comes down to data analytics. So everything revolves around data and machine learning. So to analyze that collected data to generate actionable insights on farm, such as very important optimal irrigation schedules, as an example, very important in our country. And fertilizer application, you know, we're a net importer. I think we import more than 80% of our fertilizers, and also pest management. So, yeah, we see multiple advantages of precision agriculture on farm level.
Daniel, how then do you start to approach that from a banking perspective? I mean, the banking and the financial aspects of agriculture form a critical part in supporting our farmers and our agricultural landscape. A lot of these technological advancements and maintaining a competitive advantage and a competitive edge in the market do require a capital effort. And part of that means making sure that financing houses like Nedbank Agri are able to support the farmers. From your perspective, how then do you come into the conversation and say, the use of technology is great, but we understand that it's not a cheap exercise and we're here to support that?
Yeah, I think we must remember that for us as a bank and financier and partner, you know, it is really important from a partnership perspective to partner with our clients, you know, through this whole process, because ultimately we are also impacted as a financier because we hold collateral. And as much as we can, we want to de-risk our risk and investment, you know, our lending to our client base. So yeah, from our side, we fully understand that adoption of technology can be expensive. We've seen that with significant upfront investment, as you've alluded to. So from our side, you know, banks as a whole will become definitely, and we see that process already, will become technology enablers, you know, through better credit decisions that we make, the de-risking, as I've mentioned, of our investment or lending book, with very much tailor-made solutions, you know, so on a per client level to assist our clients. So we need to look at the long-term investment as well as the long-term profitability that we will see of the investment being made. So yeah, it's very much data-focused to future-proof the industry. But that's a role that we can play. You know, we can direct, I believe, the future in terms of how and where we lend. So there's a huge responsibility on us as lenders, you know, to be involved and to be on top of what's happening currently in the market in terms of technology, because we can also benefit from it.
Ensuring that the world of agriculture benefits from precision agriculture practices, but more than that, benefits from having the right partnerships in place to ensure that a competitive advantage is maintained. The world certainly is changing, and every bit of competitive advantage is what we need for our local producers, especially when they enter the global markets. We'll have to leave the conversation on that note. Head of Sales at Nedbank Agriculture, Daniel Rousseau, joining us to take a look at precision agriculture and how it is that the bank is supporting our farmers to achieve that.
This feature was brought to you by Nedbank Commercial Banking. Grow your agribusiness. Think bigger. Think Nedbank Commercial Banking. See money differently. Nedbank.
Hi, I need finance to transport crops.
You need to get it to the right ports. With a buyer lined up across the ocean. And assurance you'll get paid. Plus funding for next season.
Well, I was thinking basic asset finance, but financial solutions
that make global trade happen
is what I should be thinking.
At Nedbank, we see more than farming. From agriculture production loans to global trade expertise, we help agribusinesses think bigger. Think Nedbank Commercial Banking. See money differently. Nedbank. We're a licensed FSP and registered credit provider. T's and C's apply.
SFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha.
Whilst we're taking a look at things that have been proposed for change, the Department of Mineral Resource, the Department of Mineral and Petroleum Resources has proposed changes to how slate levy procedures are managed. This will allow for importers in South Africa to perhaps hold on to some of that slate levy at times where global prices may fluctuate, and this might have a bearing on how much it is that we pay for the fuel that we have in our country. We're going to be taking a look at this in a bit more detail with Chief Executive Officer of the Fuels Industry Association of South Africa, Fani Shifularo. He joins me on the line now to see what we make of this. Fani, lovely having you on the show as always. Thanks so much for taking the time. Your initial thoughts around the proposed changes to the slate levy. Face value, this seems as though this would benefit consumers at the pumps in the long term.
The slate levy mechanism is supposed to benefit both the motorist and the suppliers of petroleum products. And it does, I mean, protect or smooth out the up and down movement during the course of the month. You do know that, I mean, the fuel prices are adjusted once per month in South Africa. So it means like any up and downs movement are not passed, I mean, through to the motorist during the course of that accounting month. So it then gets, I mean, recorded into a slate levy account. And then at the end of the month, we'll then look at what is the balance. I mean, if that balance is positive, it means it's the money that is owed to the motorist. But if it's negative, like it's currently the case right now, is the money that is owed to the suppliers. So it gets smoothed out over a period of time to like make sure that, I mean, we don't pass the full, like, I mean, increase, I mean, to the motorists at the same time. But right now, the biggest, I mean, pain it has been felt by the suppliers. Because right, I mean, at the height of this war in Iran, the slate balance moved to almost 18 billion negative. That means that the amount of money that has been owed to the suppliers of products. And over a period of time, the regulator increased the slate levy to, like, the highest, I think it was 152 cents. And as the balance was falling, and then they keep on reducing it. So the lowest that we have reached, it was last month, which was like 7 billion negative. That was the amount of money that is owed to the suppliers. But they reduced the slate levy. But then, like within a month, we have moved back to 10 billion owed to the companies.
Finally, the proposed changes here would effectively allow the fuel suppliers to be able to, or these companies to be able to hold on to some of that slate levy in times of increased fluctuations and not have to pay it over to the Central Energy Fund immediately. What impact would this have in terms of stabilizing and smoothing those price shocks if we are to look at those price shocks as potentially being some of the reasons why the suppliers are on the negative side of this equation at the moment?
The proposed amendment is very crucial for the purpose of ensuring security of supply, because as the prices are increasing and with the way the slate levy mechanism is designed right now, you collect the slate levy, you pay it over to SERF, and then they work out what is the balance and based on the money that has been collected, and then they pay back to you. In other words, it takes you almost 60 days to get the money back into your pocket. Yet you are like, I mean, borrowing money in order to buy products, I mean, in order to supply the market. And the impact on the cash flow is enormous. So this proposal, if it really gets, I mean, approved, it is going to reduce that, I mean, pressure on the companies in terms of cash flow, because they will be able to receive slate income much quicker than is currently the case right now.
Finally, before I let you go, can we take a look at perhaps how the rest of the proposals that are being put forward around the slate levy, or that have been gazetted rather, around some of these rule changes, could potentially have a broader impact on the fuel conversation in South Africa and on the African continent? We know that South Africa is not just an importer of fuels in aggregate for our own markets, but we supply other markets as well. Would this make us more competitive in that space? Would this have any impact on that, on those other markets as well?
So what it does, it gives the suppliers a breathing space. In other words, rather than having to run to the bank to borrow more money to acquire products, they are able to use the slate levy income that they will have received much earlier to purchase the products. So because the companies generally, they don't only look for the local market, they look at their customers even in the neighboring countries. So from the security of supply perspective, this amendment, as much as it might look as if it's small, it's very major in terms of how it does address the issue of affordability of products, especially when you are buying it at these high fuel prices at this point in time.
Proposing new measures to potentially smooth out the pain of fuel price shocks for South African consumers and suppliers in general, the new proposed adjustments to the slate levy currently gazetted are in an effort to hopefully make things a little bit easier for us. We'll have to leave the conversation on that note. Chief Executive Officer of the Fuels Industry Association of South Africa, Fanishi Fularo, joining us to share his thoughts on the gazetted slate levy adjustments that have been proposed.
With a complete view of your finances, Nedbank Private brings every aspect of your financial life together to create solutions tailored to your evolving needs. From private banking and lending to long-term financial planning and wealth management, Nedbank Private supports you at every stage of your financial journey. While others see only part of you, we see all of you. See money differently. Nedbank Private. We're a licensed FSP and registered credit provider. T's and C's apply.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
It is Property Tuesday time, and we're going to be taking a look at what could potentially be a significant property transaction that has been given the relevant approvals to proceed. 98.48% of the votes that were cast by Ballin shareholders have approved the Public Investment Corporation-backed buyout of Baldwin and subsequent delisting. We're going to be taking a look at that as part of our property conversation with independent economist, who used to also be independent property economist, John Lewis, to see if we can make sense of these developments. John, lovely having you on the show. As always, thanks so much for taking the time. You and I never got the opportunity to catch up when the initial proposal was announced and when the initial news broke that the PIC was interested in delisting Baldwin Properties. So I suppose we can start off our conversation with your thoughts on the transaction as a whole and your thoughts around the approval marking a significant step forward here. Oh, John, I think we've lost you there for a sec. Let's see if we can get you back on a better line. While we do that, let me perhaps give you, as I said, a sense of this particular transaction. The general meeting that was held yesterday was held, and it required a special resolution to execute this buyout transaction. Special resolutions typically are 75% or more. There were about almost 80% of the votable shares that turned out to vote for this particular deal to go ahead. The vote passed 98.48% in favor. Only 1.5% of shareholders voted against the special resolution number one, where it relates to the particular transaction going ahead. This would effectively mean that going forward, subject to any other approvals required by the likes of competition commissions and the like, that the Public Investment Corporation would buy out all of the shares that are outstanding and currently authorized and listed in Baldwin Properties. Once that then takes place, the intention, of course, is to delist that Borwin asset, and it would then form part of the Public Investment Corporation's portfolio in aggregate. So at the moment, as it stands, that vote moving things forward, moving things in the right direction. The value of the transaction, a little over 2.3 billion rands. And that certainly is something the PIC has the balance sheet for and the capacity for, but something that would certainly bolster their property portfolio if we look at it. Currently, if I'm not mistaken, it works out to around 4 Rand 35 per share. Yeah, 4 Rand 35 cents per share for those shares. We know that the team at Borwin had previously expressed that they were happy for the deal to go ahead. We did try to get hold of them. We weren't able to get commentary out of the PIC or Borwin at this stage, purely because the transaction itself is still ongoing and will still be subject to, I suppose, the relevant approvals. But while we do try to get John back on the line with us, perhaps let's see if we can pay some bills.
I'm Nobukhanya Mdambo, the host of MoneyWeb's small business podcast, Mzansi Business, built around the real voices of South African entrepreneurs. This is where the conversation becomes real, where business owners share what it actually takes to build, not just succeed, but survive. We shine the spotlight on local businesses, their challenges, growth, and what it takes to succeed. Each episode becomes a moment of truth, a decision point, a lesson, a turning point in a real business journey.
The podcast delivers deep, honest conversations with entrepreneurs navigating real decisions. This is where trust is built.
Money, your trusted source for business and investment insights.
Did you know that South Africa has one of the highest crypto adoption rates in the world? Fact. With that comes massive innovation and new opportunities. Stablecoins are the new buzzword in the industry. These are crypto versions of the Rand, the Euro, and the US dollar. But what's coming is even more exciting. Being able to borrow against your crypto and buying tokenized real-world assets such as stocks, wine, football teams, and real estate. Join me, Kieran Ryan, on the MoneyWeb Crypto Podcast each week to stay on top of what's happening in the fascinating world of crypto.
With a complete view of your finances, Nedbank Private brings every aspect of your financial life together to create solutions tailored to your evolving needs. From private banking and lending to long-term financial planning and wealth management, Nedbank Private supports you at every stage of your financial journey. While others see only part of you, we see all of you. See money differently. Nedbank Private. We're a licensed FSP and registered credit provider. T's and C's apply.
I'm Nobukhanya Mdambo, the host of MoneyWeb's small business podcast, Mzansi Business, built around the real voices of South African entrepreneurs. This is where the conversation becomes real, where business owners share what it actually takes to build, not just succeed, but survive. We shine the spotlight on local businesses, their challenges, growth, and what it takes to succeed. Each episode becomes a moment of truth, a decision point, a lesson, a turning point in a real business journey.
The podcast delivers deep, honest conversations with entrepreneurs navigating real decisions. This is where trust is built.
Money, your trusted source for business and investment insights.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
It seems connectivity gremlins are going to prevent us from concluding that conversation around the Borwin property acquisition by the Public Investment Corporation. But perhaps I can give you a sense of some of the other outstanding figures there. There is a premium on that share price that I mentioned, or that share offer. It's a 41% premium on the 6 month average price of the shares trading price. The current chief executive officer of the Borwin Group holds around 33% of those shares through an entity that he controls. The new entity that the Public Investment Corporation will be establishing is going to hold just under 50%, 49.3% of that Borwin business. We're going to see if we can come back to this story perhaps later in the week. For now, though, it is coming up to 7 o'clock, which means we are out of time. Greg Ghose and the SAFM News team are standing by with the latest round of Even evening news. They will, of course, be followed by Michael Abramson and the Top Sport team. From my side, good night.